You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for October 9th, 2015. This week, I'm going to talk about possible thrombosis of bioprosthetic aortic valves, coronary calcium, amiodarone, remote ischemic preconditioning, and an interesting study on cancer in the heart. First up, I want to talk about a big new development in the world of structural cardiology. And this was an analysis of 187 patients that had both surgical and transcatheter aortic valve replacement. The investigators were from Cedars-Sinai and two other centers. The study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine along with two editorials. The analysis involved 187 patients that had 4D CT scans after their valve surgery. 55 of the patients came from a randomized controlled trial, St. Jude Portico trial. And 132 came from two physician-initiated registries. Now, the key finding was that 40% of the patients from the Portico trial and 13% of the patients had evidence on 4D CT scan of decreased aortic leaflet mobility issues. Now, all of these cases were subclinical. Transthoracic echoes didn't pick it up. Warfarin anticoagulation seemed to make a difference. Patients who were anticoagulated did not have leaflet mobility issues. And in patients who had follow-up CT scans, anticoagulation resolved mobility issue in all cases. And in patients who did not have anticoagulation started, 90% of them had the problem remained. And in the registry portion of the study, the 132 patients in the registries, there was a higher incidence of stroke or TIA in the group of patients that had leaflet mobility problems. But the absolute number of events was too small to make much of the clinical outcomes data. So to review this is big. Leaflet mobility issues were commonly found. All of the issues were subclinical. Transthoracic echo did not show any differences in gradients. It was seen in multiple prosthesis types, including surgical replacements. There was a lower prevalence with anticoagulation, and anticoagulation seemed to resolve the issue. And additionally, there were abnormal opacities seen on the corresponding leaflets. And so the investigators suggested as a possible cause of the leaflet mobility issues thrombosis. This is a provocative study. I'm working on a column on this, and surely there'll be more research to come on this. Next, I wanted to move to coronary calcium. Two studies published in JACC this week address the issue of using coronary calcium to further predict cardiovascular risk. The first study, the senior author was Dr. Harlan Krumholz from Yale, was an analysis of more than 4,700 patients from the MESA longitudinal study. Now, they found that almost half the group in MESA that were statin eligible. Now, that is, if you use the new risk-based 7.5% risk cutoff, half the patients were statin eligible. But here, the key finding was that that 44% of the statin-eligible patients had zero coronary calcium. And in patients who had zero coronary calcium, the actual incidence of events was 4%, which is below the 7.5% cutoff. So when I spoke with Dr. Krumholz, and he said that for people who were in the statin-eligible group but were reluctant to take statins, perhaps they could use a coronary calcium scan to actually do less. In an editorial accompanying this paper, Dr. Lloyd-Jones from Northwestern, he even noted that coronary calcium has an advantage because it's a disease screening rather than risk screening. Now, what he means by that is when you see coronary calcium, you're actually looking at atherosclerotic disease rather than risk. Now, there's not general agreement on this. Many people are concerned about the incidental findings that you get when you look at these scans. And another problem cited is that there's not randomized controlled data showing that using coronary calcium changes future outcomes. Now, Krumholz counters that that only patients reluctant to take statins should have these scans. If you're fine taking a statin drug, then just take the statin drug. He also counters that there's no randomized controlled evidence for using the risk calculators, but we use the risk calculators. Now, the second coronary calcium study was, again, investigators that used the MESA database, and they created and validated a novel risk algorithm that used traditional risk factors and coronary calcium. And they found that when they added coronary calcium to this risk algorithm, they got really good discrimination between non-events and events. Their ROC statistic went up to 0.81, which is pretty darn good. They then validated this risk algorithm in two other longitudinal cohorts. Now, just two comments on these two studies. First, as a minimalist, I'm a skeptic of pill-based interventions. I love the idea of finding ways to do less with drugs. But on the other hand, I'm very, very concerned about doing scans when you expect to find or want to find or hope to find a negative result. That's a recipe for trouble in medicine. I'm also very concerned about patients getting entered into the healthcare system. I mean, once you get a scan and they find something, it's very difficult to extract yourself from further testing. Next, I want to talk about amiodarone. Now, few drugs are more misunderstood. You could almost write a book about amiodarone myths. So I bet you that 90% of people believe that amiodarone continues to build up over the years. That's a myth. And so is the idea that amiodarone causes optic neuropathy. Now, a recent study, which got by peer reviewers and editors, was published in the journal Ophthalmology. Not only does this study not show that amiodarone causes optic neuropathy, it also shows and exemplifies so much of what is wrong with the interpretation of clinical evidence. The study was a retrospective population-based cohort study from Taiwan. They looked at thousands of patients who took amiodarone, and then they looked at even more patients who were age and gender matched. And they found a very small difference in incidence, but because they looked at so many thousands of patients, the p-value was significant. But the absolute numbers, listen to this, 0.3% of the amiodarone patients had evidence of optic neuropathy versus 0.1% in the control group. So that's a delta of 2 in 1,000. The Kaplan-Meier survival curves y-axis was all of 0.5. Now this is crazy because the main thing is, why wouldn't we think that amiodarone treated patients are a completely different population than patients not taking amiodarone? So I reached out to two of my go-to experts on amiodarone by email, and they sent me to a couple references, which I'll link below. One was a Scudheft RCT. Now, it's an RCT which showed no difference in placebo and amiodarone-treated groups in optic issues. And the other was a 2014 analysis which compared optic neuropathy in the general population versus amiodarone reports to the FDA. Now, this analysis actually showed that the incidence of optic neuropathy in a general population, 2.3, and the amiodarone, actual estimated amiodarone incidence, 1.6 per 100,000. So that's actually a relative reduction of optic neuropathy in amiodarone-treated patients. My friends, I'm not promoting the willy-nilly use of amiodarone. This is a serious drug, but the nonsense needs to stop. Do not buy into the red herring that is this cumulative toxicity issue. Amiodarone, like all drug, reaches steady state. Now, for some patients, amiodarone is extremely useful, and we shouldn't deny it because of fear and misunderstanding. And also, this is a perfect example of relative versus absolute risks. Here, the relative risk reduction in the first study was 60%, but the absolute risk reduction 2 in 1,000 in a group of patients that surely has confounding variables. Next up, I want to talk about remote ischemic preconditioning. Now, I'm sad about this trial. It would have been so cool if this technique worked. I mean, the idea of protecting organs by squeezing a blood pressure cuff for 5 minutes off and on would have just been great stuff. And in June, a study published in JAMA, June of this year, a study published in JAMA showed that remote ischemic preconditioning showed some benefit in renal protection for post-heart surgery patients. But it's not to be. This week, two separate large-scale randomized controlled trials published in the New England Journal showed no difference with remote ischemic preconditioning. I mean, there's just no way to look at this data and see anything positive. So I'm pretty sure the case is closed on this one. And finally, I want to talk about an interesting study with cancer and cardiotoxicity. Now, it's well known that chemotherapy radiation can be cardiotoxic. But what I didn't know before reading this was the idea that cancer itself may harm the heart. Now, either through tumor-specific vasoactive peptides or pre-existing comorbidities that cancer patients have, or perhaps diffuse generalized inflammation. Now, I'll point you to a really nifty study, Austrian investigators publishing in the BMJ Heart Journal. They looked prospectively at more than 500 patients with cancer in their clinic, none of whom had cardiotoxic treatments. They measured high-sensitivity troponin and five other neurohormones, and they found that these markers were elevated significantly, but more importantly, were strongly related to all-cause mortality. So in the article in the Medscape, in the HeartWire on Medscape article, they quoted Dr. Stephen Ewer, a cardio-oncologist from the University of Wisconsin, who said this was an important discovery that may be a useful area of future research. It's definitely an interesting finding. So that's it for this week in cardiology. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the heart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the heart.org on Medscape.